Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Extra Sauce Podcast.
It's my fancy sauce.
I want some fancy sauce.
Yeah.
I'm not done using it.
With the czar of sauces, Greg Hill.
This is going to be a weird one. Just a warning. All right, Shu, I'm going to start right off and tell you that Shu has become, in the space of a day and a half or 3 days or whatever it was since Monday, when the flat earth guy called the show, you've become a flat earther.
Whoa, whoa, okay.
You're a flat earther.
I don't know. Things are starting to make sense. Let me just say that.
Listen,
okay.
You smoke an S-load of pot, so first of all, you believe a lot of this stuff anyway. This is nuts. So today on Extra Sauce, this particular episode of Extra Sauce, we're going to talk with Mark Sargent, who is an advisor to the Flat Earth Council, Flat Earth organization.
Flat Earth Society, but he's got his own thing going.
Yes, he does.
He's his own entity.
Yes,
and when it comes to the Flat Earth theories.
The man is, at the very least, wildly intelligent and quite possibly completely insane. However,
there's a fine line.
He is going to try to convince you that the Earth is flat. So I'm also very excited to tell you that we are going to go behind the ear moth with the artist who is responsible for one of the most, if not the most, talked about ear moths ever on the Hillman Morning Show. And that's Henry Gross, who had a hit in 1976 with Shannon. So, and Shu was able to track him down. He's living in Florida.
Yep. Yeah.
Florida, not like the rest of us.
That's right.
Probably hangs out with Bertie Higgins. Bertie Higgins is also in Florida,
I believe. Bertie is a Floridian. Yeah. Yes, he is.
Yes, yes,
remember,
yes.
Good friends with Burt Reynolds.
And I'm telling you, I got to get the details on this, but I'm thinking of, I might as well just say this before we talk to Mark. I'm thinking of doing a fundraiser for the Greg Hill Foundation where we get 5 or 6 or 7 ear moth artists to come to town and play their ear moth.
Festival.
Like an ear moth palooza or ear moth, whatever it is. So I'm going to ask Henry if he's up for that. However, we begin with the advisor to the Flat Earth Organization.
Yeah.
Mark Sargent,
right.
who you found because he's an expert on this.
Right. Well, we mentioned the Flat Earth Society on the air and the whole theory because of Shaq.
Yeah,
and then
Shaq.
A lot of some people tweeted at me, some people emailed me and said, you got to, don't talk to them.
Yeah.
You got to talk to Mark Sargent. He's the man.
Well, this began, let's listen to Shaq at the beginning of the week, who says the Earth is flat.
It's true. The
what?
The Earth is flat.
And then we got a call from Steve, a listener, who insisted the Earth was flat. And so Mark joins us right now. And he's going to convince all of us that we have been living a long lie, a lifelong lie. When we were told in school that the Earth was round, we were being lied to. And Mark, thanks for being on Extra Sauce.
Thank you very much for having me.
A lot of people think you're batshit crazy, but
I know.
Actually, you know what, Shu is becoming a believer.
Let's slow down. I've been reading up on this since I knew we were going to talk to you, and I don't know, some of it to me, I'm a conspiracy theory kind of guy.
Oh yeah.
Some of it to me, it freaks me out a little bit how much I kind of buy here.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, we're as a skeptic, but the whole enclosed dome thing.
Well, Mark, I wanted to ask you first. When did you start to believe that the Earth was flat? Like when did you start to really believe this?
It hit me. My Jerry Maguire moment for the flat Earth was February 10th of 2015. Woke up in the middle of the night after looking at this thing and trying to debunk it because nobody likes it. It's a piece of crap theory.
Yeah.
And everybody starts up. The T-shirt reads, "I became a flat earther because I tried to debunk flat earth." And I tried for months and months, woke up on February 10th and said, you know what? I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to make a series of videos. I'm going to put it out on the internet. I'm going to see if anybody challenges it. And honestly, I thought for the first week or month or whatever, I thought, you know what, some scientist, some academic's going to shoot this thing down in 2 seconds because it's easy, right? It's easy. Everyone knows it's an easy thing to debunk. And the exact opposite happened. Massive amounts of people started contacting me. Subject matter experts started calling in. I got to get, you know, unsolicited. I was interviewing all these people. They turned it into a book and a website and apps. And, you know, here we are 2 years later. And now I'm putting videos about how Shaquille O'Neal is not a flat earther.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Well, that's how the discussion started on the morning show. And honestly, I mean, people were texting in. Like saying, explain why you're out on the ocean and you can see essentially the horizon and where it spills over. I mean, how do you explain that stuff?
Oh, sure. No, there is a horizon line, of course, but that's just the limit of your perception. That's just your vision only goes so far. Now, what's interesting is when people will say, "Oh, well, you can see the boat going over the horizon." That's the most common thing we get.
Yeah,
it's like, okay. And here's what's changed since the last time any flat earth thing has really come up. And it's been a long, long time since this thing has been a topic. Find a camera like a Coolpix 900 with like an 80 power zoom. A boat goes over the horizon. You see it go away, right? And you think it's gone and it's gone over the horizon. You take your camera and you can zoom and bring it back into frame. And you can do this again and again until finally the atmosphere gets so thick, you know, because you can only see so far because, you know, we're only breathing 20% oxygen. The rest is nitrogen. The boat should not be there. And by that, I mean, if anyone's listening, they were trying to figure this out with math. If the curvature is 8 inches per mile squared, and I know everyone hates math, so yeah. I'll do it for you. That means that it's every mile times itself times 8 inches. So if it's 10 miles, it's 10 times 10, which is 100, times 8 inches, which is 800 inches. There should be 800 inches of curvature at 10 miles. And it just gets worse and worse. So at 50 miles, for example, it should be 50 times 50 times 8, which is roughly, you know, pushing 1,700 feet of curvature. You should not see anything because it's on the other side of the hill, and yet we see objects time. In fact, I put a challenge out there a year ago. I said, find me an object at less than 200 miles that we can't see. We can see the Chicago skyline over Lake Michigan, 50 miles, so any day of the week, time lapse. I talked to a missile instructor who from the United States Navy, who said, yeah, we're painting targets with a beam radar ship to ship at 50 nautical miles, which is about 60 miles on land because nautical miles is bigger. He goes, that's impossible. It cannot be. That's 2,000 feet of curvature. We should not be able to paint the target. And it just goes on and on and on. But yeah, that's the horizon.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. But also, you mentioned, and some stuff I was reading, you mentioned Admiral Byrd and Antarctica. And yeah. That he would fly around in a plane and fly around in a plane. And I'm thinking of that. People are flying around in planes all over Earth. How do they not see if it's flat, how do they not see that? The supposed...
That's a great question because lots of people will say, well, you know, pilots would have to be in on it and scientists would have to, and everybody in NASA would have to be in. No, nobody's in on it. It's so big. And anyone that's trying to figure out, I don't know how you introduce this thing. But everyone's trying to visualize this. Look, you're in, and I know this is going to blow people's heads open, you're in a very, very large version of the Truman Show, which means that if it is a Truman Show, you know, enclosed system, that means the ground is more or less perfectly flat. All the pilots that I've talked to, the air traffic controllers, the flight instructors, military pilots, civilian pilots, they've all said the same thing. It's like, look, when you get up to altitude, yeah, we all know, we all see a very perfectly flat horizon, but we're taught since we're kids that it's a globe. So it's this weird paradox. It's like, okay, how do you know that's curved? And the pilots, they honestly, they all say the same thing. They go, you know, we missed it because we're too busy. It's like, what if we start in point A and land in point B and nobody dies? That's a good day for a pilot. So we don't worry about it. And well, the ones that do, who are they going to tell? So, no, pilots know full well when they're looking up there that's a flat horizon, but they can't do anything about it. Sorry.
Go ahead. So, no, I mean, it's you're either wildly intelligent or you're a complete nut job kook. I mean, this dome theory, let's get into this because we mentioned it briefly at the start. You think that we're living under an enclosed dome, an enclosed world.
Yeah. Take your pick as far as terminology. You want to say terrarium, planetarium, snow globe, wildlife preserve, amusement park ride, sports stadium, because that's really, you know, it doesn't have to be a high arcing snow globe. It could be a very, very shallow stadium, because most of our civilization only lives from sea level to about maybe 1 mile up. That's about 5,000 feet. That's 95% of our population. And even if the barrier of this thing, the upper edge of this thing was, let's say, a couple thousand miles high, that's still very shallow in terms of the grand scheme of things. And people say, well, you know, the edge, you're talking about the edge of the world. I'm going, yeah, I am. I'm saying that the United States and the Soviet Union during Operation Deep Freeze in 1956 were looking for this thing. They had the old maps. They tried to figure it out. They looked for 30 years. Admiral Byrd was down looking in Antarctica for 30 years, from 1928 until 1956. They found it. It took them that long to find it, because it's way in. It's not like it's the coastline of Antarctica. You have to really, really go inland to find the outer marker of this thing. And once they found it, they sealed off Antarctica forever. And that's it's one of the greatest secrets that nobody knows. Like, look up the Antarctic Treaty. It's not a hidden document.
So wait, what did they find?
They found the edge.
In my opinion, it was the... If I had a, this is my opinion, of course, but there's a lot of people in the community they'll go with this. They found the barrier, the wall, the fence.
Yeah,
you want to call it the Game of Thrones wall. Now, what it's made out of, we have no freaking idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be a heavy element, a heavy water, a frequency, a force field, electromagnetic. We don't know. But once they found it, they realized, okay, we can't let anyone near this thing. So they basically created a treaty that is the most impenetrable treaty of all time. All countries have to sign this once you become an economic power, that says if you have a corporation, you are not allowed to set up shop in Antarctica ever, forever. It's not even up for debate. And that was from 1959. It's not even for up debate until 2041. And that's it. And that raises so many eyebrows in our community. It's like, look, greed, money, power, that rules the world. And you're telling me my corporation, my oil company, no matter who I bribe, who I grease palms, I can't go down there? Nah, not buying it.
Did Admiral Byrd ever say anything about it, or was he silenced?
Well, that's a great question, because he was, you know, down there from 1928 up until his last mission in 1956. And then he died in 1957, and, you know, from supposedly at his home from a heart failure. You're looking at the guy, when you watch his interview in 1954, when he went on the CBS show Long Jeans Chronoscope, and that's on YouTube, you can look this up, when he's talking about how Antarctica is going to be full of resources that you can fuel the world for a long time to come, and everybody's going to be fighting over it. He looked perfectly healthy to me.
Mm.
And I'm sure he was a man of integrity, you know, youngest admiral in the United States Navy of all time, probably the greatest explorer of all time. And I think they looked at him and they said, yeah, he's not going to be able to keep quiet about this.
You also said one of the founders of NASA, one of their main scientists, when he died, he left a clue on his tombstone, because supposedly he believed they were biblical references, right? And those had to do with being enclosed.
Yeah. That was a gem that we just stumbled across. Wernher von Braun, and some people will know the name, the ex-Nazi scientist. You don't think, again, that NASA's an accident founded on the still burning embers of the Nazi war machine. He, when he died, I thought his gravestone would have been a giant statue of him holding a rocket up and pointing at the sky. But instead, it was a very modest headstone, and it only had three things on it. His name, the year he was born, the year he died, and a Bible verse. And in fact, it didn't even list the Bible verse. It said Psalms 19:1, which, if you look it up, it says, "And the firmament shows his handiwork." Why in the world would the father of rocket science, literally the rocket scientist, why would he be talking about a domed structure? Why would he be talking about something that's covering us? He would be one of the few people that would have to know. Remember, he was the guy that said in the 50s that we're not going to the moon anytime soon. We'd have to use three spaceships the size of the Empire State Building, and it would we don't have the tech for it. And then a couple years later, he's going, oh, yeah, we can totally do it.
Well, Mark, I mean, listen, I'm a dope. Like, yeah. I didn't even graduate from high school. So explain to me.
I got thrown out of college.
Yeah, I hope you're not working at another one now, because you may be thrown out for this stuff. When I see pictures of the Earth from space, it's round.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I know we don't have a ton of time, so I will break this one down real quick for you. First picture of Earth ever taken in direct sunlight. You can look this up. Not secret information. 1972, from Apollo 17, the first picture of the Earth in full sunlight. You got two things. One, you got to wonder why Apollo 8 through Apollo 16 never took this picture. But then, do you know when the second picture of Earth was taken?
No.
Two years ago. In fact, not even 2 years ago. 43 years, and they only used one picture of the Earth from space. And you're saying, well, oh, no, I can look up on the internet and see all these pictures of the Earth from space. I looked up in the year in 2000 just for because I was looking for images of the Earth space. Literally, there was only that image time and time again. The first iPhone that was released, you probably remember this, had the background of the Earth. It was the blue marble shot. The guy that made that image, literally made that image, Scott Simmons, did an audio interview where he's going, oh, yeah, I had to Photoshop it and I can create that image for the iPhone because there were no images to use.
So you're basically saying it's like, it's like every single person's dating profile, like when they're online and they're using a picture from 20 years ago.
Right.
There you go. It's a really blurry headshot. Yeah. Absolutely. It's amazing the lack of things when you go to look at NASA, because everyone wants to lean on NASA for this. Like, I can disprove it by leaning on NASA. So many things that aren't there. Yeah, of course, you're going to have some live streams and some footage here and there, but there's so much more that should be there that isn't.
What's the biggest piece, like the single biggest piece of evidence that convinced you that the Earth was flat?
Wow, it's really kind of a compilation, kind of like when you go to the mechanic and they say, well, you know, when you buy another car and they say, well, it's a lot of little things that are wrong with it. If I had to pick two things for people to look that they can test themselves or look at themselves, one on the ground and one in space. The curvature was a big one for me once I started getting going with this, and that is the 8 inches per, you know, when you go out in the water and you think you see a curvature. In fact, you want to see the curvature. I still have people that say, oh, no, I can see the curvature of the beach. And it's like, no, you can't. Mm. Or I can see it from a mountaintop. No, you can't. Or an airplane, I go, okay, fine. And I put this challenge out there 18 months ago. I said, look, tell me, if you see a picture, don't dig up one from online. Take the picture yourself, put it on a laptop, hold a straight up edge to it. Tell me if you still see the curve. If you see a curve, then you send it to me. I will quit flat Earth. It's never happened. I can show you balloon footage, you know, non-fisheye lens. Don't give me that Red Bull Felix Baumgartner crap.
Wow.
At 121,000 feet, it is perfectly flat. That's the ground stuff you can test. Anyone can go to a beach right now and do that test right now, or look at a ship in the distance and crank your zoom up on your phone. The other one is a question that was never answered, which just threw me, which is the Van Allen radiation belt, which was, you know, announced in 1959 by Van Allen himself, and yet deadliest things ever. People cannot go through them. You will die. That was Van Allen's thing, and yet Apollo 8 through Apollo 17 went round trip through them. Nobody died. Nobody got radiation poisoning. Nobody got cancer. And when you go to ask NASA, we've tried. You ask NASA, what shielding did you use? Radiation, you can protect yourself two ways. You can use lead or you can use gold. That's it. What shielding did you use? Nothing. Because it's too heavy. You couldn't do it. You can't shield a capsule with a super heavy metal. It's like putting an anchor on top of a rocket. You don't do it. And no one ever explains it. And you say, okay, that doesn't really convince me of flat Earth. So go, okay, go to the simple website. You can find this in 2 seconds. Go to NASA.gov or just look up a video called Orion Trial by Fire. It's a video they put together, won a local Emmy. NASA, it was on television, where they talk about the Orion Project, how they're going to go to Mars. But they had this weird section in there where they were talking. It's like, oh, yeah, we got to figure out how we're going to get through the Van Allen radiation belts because the first capsules we're going to launch are going to be unmanned because we haven't solved this problem of the Van Allen belt, the radiation problem yet. That's like, what are you talking about? You solved it already. You solved it, in fact, in the 1960s. Why are you even talking about that? Those are just two instances I point people at, but there's so much stuff out there. But fire away. What else you got?
Well, no, listen. I mean, honestly, I could talk forever. We were laughing about this discussion on the morning show. I'm intrigued by it, I will say.
I'll say that, yeah.
I'm intrigued by it. And I think those that are enjoying the extra sauce on this would probably like to go to your website. So you might want to share that.
Oh, yeah. The easiest way, and I'm not going to just promote my stuff, just go into YouTube and type in Flat Earth. If you want to see my stuff, type in Flat Earth Clues. And the website is called enclosedworld.com. Flat Earth Clues has been turned into an audiobook and it's translated in a whole bunch of languages. And again, don't think for a second that Shaq and Draymond and Kyrie and I don't know why people are leaving Richard Jefferson out of this. He's the biggest instigator of them all. This is not a fluke. B.O.B. was a fluke last year, maybe, but not now. This thing is going to just get bigger and bigger.
Well, thanks for joining us under the dome here on here on Extra Sauce. I suspect that we'll probably have you on another upcoming episode of Extra Sauce because I think people are going
to
be intrigued, Mark. So thanks. Now, listen, you're not currently living in an insane asylum or anything like that.
Currently, right as we speak, I am in Victoria, Canada, but I grew up in the Seattle area and then spent 20 years in Colorado teaching people software.
All right. Well, thanks for being on with us, man. Thank you. We'll talk to you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Cuckoo. What do you, honestly?
I don't know, Greg. I'm starting to absorb some of this, and it's somehow making sense.
The Antarctica stuff is interesting.
Yeah, that treaty. If you think about it, because everyone's scrambling now that the polar caps are melting to drill for oil around the North Pole.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to be going down to Antarctica, though.
But that's the end. That's what they're saying.
That's what Mark was saying.
These nut jobs. They're saying the end, the world, the Earth ends.
Right.
Right there in Antarctica. If you stepped over, you'd fall off into another galaxy or another.
That's the edge. Well, according to him, you wouldn't because we're an enclosed world.
Oh, we're in a dome. Yeah.
We're in a dome. Right, right, so you would hit the dome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, Greg.
I think he's on something, as my mom would say.
You know what? I may be on something myself. It's starting to make sense.
I believe that this will lead to further discussion.
Yes.
At some point. Now, am I to understand that we got new announcer guy to do an official intro for Behind the Ear Moth?
I think since it went so well, we should have one.
Do you think that new announcer guy is growing on people, or do you think there's still a lot of frustration with the level, the deepness in his voice?
I know nobody likes change.
Yes,
you know, and it's hard sometimes. You get so used to someone. I like new announcer guy. I think it's kind of a breath of fresh air.
Okay.
Although, you know, here, especially in New England, change is never received well.
But, you know, we live in interesting times, and people don't want to be spoken to in a deep voice. They want everything to be easy and comforting.
Yeah. I think he's doing a great job, you know, and I think maybe we could invite him here.
Yeah.
And we could send him out with LB.
Oh, yeah. And then
and Gronk in a party bus. Right. You know, maybe that might change some things.
And I do want to point out that we were not going to go back-to-back episodes of Extra Sauce with Behind the Ear Moth, but this opportunity presented itself, and it was impossible to say no. There was no way that we were going to say no. So let's go Behind the Ear Moth.
It's time to go Behind the Ear Moth on the Extra Sauce Podcast.
All right, quite possibly the most talked about ear moth ever played on the morning show was Shannon by an artist named Henry Gross.
Yep.
And it was a hit song in 1976. And in case you haven't heard it, here's a little bit of the hook right now. And it's about a dog who died. And I think when we discovered that during the show, there were some who were alarmed that there was a song written about a dog dying.
Right. How could it be such a huge hit?
Yeah. In fact, we'll discuss this with Henry, but there's one legendary radio announcer in history who was very upset that there was a song about a dog dying. Mike Shue has tracked down Henry. And the song is written about Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys and the death of his dog. And Henry joins us right now for a little extra sauce on the ear moth Shannon.
Who? I'm sorry, he's not here. Mr. Gross has not received a check. He gets on when the money comes.
It is a pleasure to have the artist responsible for one of the most talked about ear moths on our program on the podcast. And we're going to get a little extra sauce from you today about the legendary Shannon. And I have never had a response like that of the listeners. the first time that I played Shannon. And I shared with everybody because, I love a finely crafted pop song. I mean, that's my thing. And in 1976, I was 10 years old. I ran down to Woolworths in Maynard, and I bought the 45 as soon as I heard it. And
Maynard, Massachusetts?
Yes, yes. What do you know?
I lived in Maynard.
You did? Wait a minute.
I lived in Maynard. I lived in a house with Stuart Shulman, who played violin and bass for Jonathan Edwards, who's one of my dearest friends. And also in the house, that's where I met Philip Auberg. And it's a great story because I was sleeping one night. I woke up in the morning and I heard the most amazing piano playing I'd ever heard in my life. And I thought I was dreaming. And I went downstairs and it was Phil Auberg, who wound up playing on Shannon and Plugged Me Into Something and everything else.
What year was that you lived in Maynard?
Oh, man. Probably 1971. Because
huh.
I left Sha-Na 1970 or 71 because I left Sha-Na-Na in 70 and then went out and moved up to Boston.
Do you remember the Woolworths that was right downtown? That's where I used to go buy my 45s with my paper route money every week.
Do you know, my recollection of Maynard was rowing on the Concord River. I mean, I used to go. You could rent rowboats, and I would just row indefinitely. I lost 30 pounds. It was great. I actually got a career.
Well, I played Shannon. I played Shannon the first time, and then people were wondering what the song was about, and so I explained that tragically it was about the death of a dog, and people lost their minds over it. They were very upset. There were tears. There were people who needed a safe zone, and so we've discussed the fact that the song is about the death of the dog of Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Hey, you know, the only person that didn't cry was Casey Kasem. He cursed.
Yes, yes. We got to talk about that too. But how did you end up? Tell us the story about writing that song about Shannon.
I was touring a lot with the Beach Boys and became good friends with Carl. And I was in L.A. for some reason or other, I can't remember. And I went to Carl's house for lunch. He was living right near the Beverly Hills Hotel. And we were about to eat. He had a beautiful spread laid out. And as I say in my show, One Hit Wanderer, I'll never know what it tasted like. Because before I could get a bite, his giant husky dogs jumped up and knocked everything off the table and ate everything. It was unbelievable. They attacked the table. And he was so nice, he couldn't stop apologizing. I said, Carl, don't worry about it. I have a lunatic Irish setter at home called Shannon. And he said, wow, he had a dog named Shannon that was hit by a car and killed not long before, and he was very upset about it. And so I got back to New York, and I was sitting on the bed with my Shannon thinking about Carl, and I just drifted off and wrote the song in about 10 minutes.
But in the song, Shannon drifts away at sea. Now, it's not hit by a car, right?
Well, you know, I mean, how, you know, does it matter? I mean, it's a song. It's, you know, it's
artistic license.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't the 6 o'clock news. It's a song. You know, you take it. And besides, it wasn't even my choice.
Right.
Because I say to people, I didn't write it. I wrote it down.
What did Carl Wilson think of Shannon?
I loved it.
Yeah.
He loved it. I mean, I sent it to him when I recorded it. Actually, when I wrote it, I thought, you know, this is right about the time the Beach Boys were in a lull. And I wrote the song and I sent it, if you remember those big cassette machines like that Sony made, they looked the size of shoe boxes.
Yes.
When they first came out. Well, I had one of those and I recorded the song. And at the end, right after I wrote it, and I sang it into this box. And at the end, my Shannon barked. It was great. So I sent it to Carl, and I never heard a word.
Huh.
Nothing. I wanted them to cut it. Of course, you know, I thought it would be great, you know. And never heard a word about it. So I recorded it. I tried to, you know, I couldn't reach him for a couple of months. So I was doing an album, and I just said, I'm going to cut this darn thing. I love it. So we cut it and had a big hit on it. And a year later, when it had been a hit all over the world, and I saw Carl, and he came up to me with that amazing accent of his and said, Henry, I heard your song on the radio. It sounded so much better than that tape you sent me.
Oh.
and, you know, I never realized what he meant or why he said that. And I always thought that's the craziest thing anyone ever said to me.
Now, I think we all wonder about artists. And so you have a hit with Shannon in 1976. You make good money from something like that? You know, the record company situation the way it was back then. And do you still get royalties today?
I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know? Do you not own it?
I wouldn't know. I do not own any of the publishing on my early works.
Huh. Oh, no.
I am the writer. I wrote them all myself, but I'm not the publisher. However, I'm friends with the guy who's the publisher, and we get along fine, and we split whatever comes in, I guess.
You mentioned the legendary Casey Kasem rant, in which Casey and we've played.
We're really going off. We're really taking the low road.
we've played. You know, Casey. We've played it millions of times on the show. And
oh, thank you. If you played the song, if you played the song a million times, I wouldn't be wearing a cardboard belt today.
I'm going to send you some cash after this podcast. Yeah. I'm going to write you a check after this. But Casey was pissed. I'm Casey Kasem. Casey was pissed because he had to play Shannon after an upbeat Pointer Sisters song. And so he didn't want to play a dead dog song and a dead dog request after an upbeat song.
Yeah. I want somebody to use his f***ing brain to not come out of a damn record that is that's up-tempo, and I got to talk about a f***ing dog dying.
What is this ponderous, man?
It made my song sound so appealing to the listening public.
Right.
You know, the truth of the matter is, I caught a lot of flack when I did the song because I had done Plug Me Into Something, which was, you know, a rock and roll record that still stands, and I get hundreds of letters a year of people that love that record. And so I did Shannon because I was working with the Beach Boys. I was in that frame of mind. I was thinking, you know, Phil Spector and Brian. And this song, as Springtime Mama did after it, just, you know, crossed through my head, and I did it. A lot of people really dumped on me and said, "Oh, it's the corniest. It's syrupy, disgusting, dead dog. I mean, how sick can it be?" But as people got older and they lost family members, parents, grandparents, dogs, you know, I think people have realized that it was a legitimate thing to write about and an important thing to write about.
The only thing that rivals it when it comes to animals and emotion is Wildfire.
Oh,
you know?
Oh, yeah.
Wildfire is great, but then we had Hound Dog. And we had How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
Right. Yeah. How many times would you guess you've played Shannon?
Shannon needs... there's another one.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I should get one of those little things that my wife has when we walk every day that tells us how far we've gone.
Yeah, yeah. Like on your iPhone.
Every time I get in the key of F and go falsetto, it should do a little click. A lot. And I've never once sung it when I wasn't proud of it. But, you know, it's funny because there will be people who will come up to me and they'll say, "Man, I really love your song."
That's awesome.
I'm thinking of, I've had this idea in my head as a benefit for my foundation. I'm thinking of putting together a special Ear Moth show in which we feature Shannon. And I'm wondering if you'd come to Boston and play it live at the show.
Are you saying please come to Boston?
Yes, we are. Yes, please come to Boston for the springtime. Yes. Well, Henry.
I love that song, by the way. It's fabulous.
I do too. Henry, thank you for taking us behind the Ear Moth when it comes to Shannon, and I'm hoping that maybe you'll, because you started already, maybe you'll sing us out with a little bit more of Shannon.
Shannon is gonna hoop, she's dripping hot to see. She always loved to swim away.
Special thanks to Henry Gross for taking us behind the Ear Moth, and to Mark Sargent for convincing us that the earth is really flat. And thanks to you loyal human beings, for listening to the Extra Sauce podcast. If you like what you heard, then please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. And while you're there, so Shu and I keep our jobs, please leave a rating and leave a Leave a great rating, please.
Please.
And help spread the extra sauce to more listeners.
And don't fall over the edge.
No. Be careful.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.